From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University, I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Candace Watt-Smith.
I'm Jenna Spinelli, and welcome to Democracy Works. This week, we are talking with Congressman Ro Khanna, who is a Democrat representing the Silicon Valley in California. He's here to talk with us about his latest book, Dignity in a Digital Age. And, you know, this book, and I think his broader mission is to help take some of the innovation and the prosperity and the wealth that exists within his district in Silicon Valley and bring it out to the rest of the country, whether that's an urban community, whether it's an urban community, a rural community. How can the rest of America benefit from all of the things that technology has brought to his district?
Yeah, and that centers most specifically around the technology as an economic engine, right? Silicon Valley, I think he says Silicon Valley is worth significantly more than the GDP of like Russia, right? It is an enormously powerful economic engine, and there's no signs of that kind of stopping. But many Americans, and especially Americans in rural communities and, you know, underserved, marginalized communities, feel that none of that is coming to them, that they have been left out of this revolution. And so Khanna says, true, that is true, and that's a problem, and that's a problem that our nation needs to address and needs to figure out ways to bring the opportunities of a digital age throughout the United States.
This book, Dignity in the Digital Age, also kind of gets at some of the themes that we talked about with, for example, with Danielle Allen, who, you know, mentioned that it is going to be really difficult. Like, we have a goal of creating a multiracial, egalitarian democracy. And I think for the representative, that means, you know, to be able to contribute and to have a say in how things are going on. But we have a lot of problems. We have a lot of challenges, you know, social media, AI, fractured media, landscape, a fractured media landscape, polarization, and then we have vast economic inequality. And by kind of thinking about ways of getting the wealth and innovation out of Silicon Valley into other communities across the country.
I mean, going back to, you know, the Urtext for us, how democracies die, they talk at the very end that there has never been a genuine egalitarian, multi-ethnic, multiracial democracy. And we have no choice but to try to construct that, make that real. Not to say, I mean, not merely to say that we should do it, right? That it's a matter of justice, but that it's incumbent upon us. We can't not do it anymore. And so what Ro Khanna is doing is arguing that this digital dimension of the economy, mm-hmm. The most fertile, the most dynamic, the most wealth-producing aspect of our economy must be extended to these other communities. And it's important to say, that's why the title is Dignity. It's not merely a matter of making a living, mm-hmm. Having some economic stability. It's also the dignity that comes from having a job that you can be proud of and be happy in, being part of this nationwide effort to build something.
One of the kind of central components here is that, you know, he says, like, people should be able to stay in their hometowns. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I have been reading a lot about the late 19th and early 20th century America, where Black people are leaving their homes, are leaving the places where they were born, to go, you know, to Chicago, New York, out west to California to get the things that they need. People don't want to do that. And, you know, I think his argument is that people shouldn't have to do that. You shouldn't have to leave your home to, you know, have good work, to be able to contribute, to have good education, so on and so forth.
And that kind of gets to this other point, which we'll talk about in the interview, but I couldn't help, as I was reading the book and having this conversation, to think about the episode that I think both of you were on with Alec McGillis about Amazon and how all of these tech jobs are not created equal. And what do you have to do to ensure that it does, that the job is not just somewhere people go to earn a paycheck? What is that connection to dignity and to community and the ways that those two things intersect? And I think that is still very much an open question, and you know, Kana kind of realizes that, but it's part of, I think he sees that as part of his project or his mission to try to figure out how to remedy some of those disparities.
There's a lot that I want to jump in with there. What can capitalism demand of us, and what can we demand as people who, as people who demand dignity, what can we demand of capitalism? But I think it makes sense first to go to his interview, and then we can come back and talk about that.
Let's go now to the interview with Congressman Ro Khanna. Congressman Ro Khanna, welcome to Democracy Works. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So before we dive into your book, Dignity in a Digital Age, I want to just talk briefly about the war in Ukraine, and specifically something that we have been grappling with on the show, and I think perhaps relates to some of your ideas about democracy. And that is, you know, is what we are seeing unfold going to be the type of shock to the system that might make America and perhaps other Western democracies realize just how fragile democracy really is? Or is it perhaps going to be something that we all watch on TV and, you know, doom scroll all day long, but see as something that's happening over there and not maybe make that connection outside of Ukraine and Russia more broadly? What is your take on that? And are you perhaps seeing any evidence from your constituents or your colleagues in Congress about how things are playing out?
I definitely think that this has rallied the American people and my colleagues to stand with Ukraine, understanding that the world is still a brutal place, that American leadership matters, that Ukraine is an example of why it's important for us to support NATO, why it's important for us to be unified at home so that people don't perceive weakness in standing up for freedom and democracy. I think the resistance of Ukraine has been extraordinary, and that has inspired Americans in many ways. People are inspired by President Zelensky and all of what they're seeing on social media. It's still a brutal war, and Russia has a lot of just manpower and a lot of equipment. So I'm hopeful that the Ukrainians can continue to hold on and put on a resistance. But at some point, there has to be a ceasefire and an off-ramp so that we can have peace. But I do think that Americans are engaged and don't view this as a distant problem, but are rallying around the president and the country.
Yeah. And you mentioned social media there. We are, of course, seeing so much of this conflict play out on social media. And I know that you represent a lot of Silicon Valley in your congressional district. You know, as we think about kind of the history of social media, there was perhaps a period of utopianism that maybe culminated in the Arab Spring, followed by a more dystopian period that perhaps culminated in the January 6th, 2021 insurrection. And it's, you know, we're sort of moving perhaps into another phase now, but it's unclear, at least to me, where things are going to go from here.
I think that there has been a huge contradiction with social media. On the one hand, it has really empowered voices that were marginalized. You saw that with the Arab Spring. You see that with the Me Too movement. You see that with Black Lives Matter. Well, you're seeing that to some extent with Ukraine, the inspiring pictures that people in Ukraine are posting and videos that they're posting of their resistance, of the heroic efforts of fathers taking their families outside and then coming back into Ukraine to fight. A lot of that we know because of social media, not traditional reporting. And it is countering a very large behemoth in Russia. On the other hand, you've had social media used with Russia itself, with Russian TV to sow disinformation. As you pointed out, it led to the January 6th, the lies and insurrection of violence. The challenge for us then is, how do we take this new medium that's created a new digital sphere and have it become more a forum for the democratization of voice, for thoughtful dialogue, rather than a place for mobilizing nationalism or extremism? And I think we're just starting on that project. Remember, it took 100 years after the printing press for that not to be used for pamphleteering that started wars. So this is a humanity's task to build the liberal democratic institutions online that can harness the internet to be a force for good.
Yeah. And I mean, as you talk with, you know, leaders from these companies that you represent in your district, how are they thinking about this challenge?
I think there's an awakening of their social responsibility, their political responsibility. I don't think that was on the forefront of their minds for many years. It was just, how do we grow our business? How do we grow more users? How do we grow more engagement? And that was the algorithms that they created and optimized for. But suddenly they realized that just growing more users, just growing more engagement doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to be a force for good. And their mission statements were not just about profit, but being a force for good. And now they realize, wow, there's some huge negatives to this, that, you know, Instagram in some ways is the worst of junior high at times. The proliferation of hate, of extremism online needs to be checked. The proliferation of misinformation needs to be checked. So they're beginning to embrace their role as new media companies. But it's not sufficient for them to do that voluntarily. We need thoughtful regulation so we can make sure that these spaces are conducive to democracy.
Yeah, and I know you write about this in your book, so let's go there and dive in. I want to start with your theory of democratic patriotism, which, as I understand it, is borrowed from Frederick Douglass and John Rawls and perhaps others. So can you lay that out for us, what it is and perhaps how you came to this theory?
Well, democratic patriotism is the view that a country is stitched together by more than procedural justice. And by that, I mean the famous view of us, of America, that we're a country based on an idea. We're a nation that is rooted in liberty and equality and a constitution. And all of that is true. But there's more to America. There's a culture to America, whether that's a sports culture, a music culture, a popular culture, and their customs and traditions. And Douglass, in this brilliant speech in 1869, talks about being a composite nation, that an American culture will emerge out of all of the different cultures in the free era of America. We will sort of build a composite. And what I write about is, how can we do that in a 21st century America, where everyone has the equality of participating in building this culture? And so we can be patriotic about America for all it stands, not just a procedural conception of America, but that it's so important that everyone has inequality in creating that. And I link that to technology in saying, if we don't have equality of technological production in a modern economy, you're not going to have inequality to participate in the creation of culture.
Yeah, and say more about that, what you mean by equality of technical production.
Well, in my district and the surrounding areas, you have $11 trillion of market cap. I mean, it's staggering. Russia's entire economy as a GDP is $1.6 trillion. And young people are very optimistic about the future. They think the world's their oyster. They want to do robotics. They want to do the next technological innovation. But the opportunities have been so concentrated. And so you have both billionaires, millionaires, and all of these techies having disproportionate cultural influence and disproportionate economic influence. And large parts of the country, rural America, black and brown communities, that have been totally excluded from modern wealth generation, not having the opportunities to build the economic prosperity in their hometowns. And so what I argue is for the decentralization of a lot of technology, the argument that the 25 million new digital jobs that pay twice the median average need to be distributed across the country.
And you give several examples in the book of this about, you know, cities and towns that are really trying to embrace this idea and, you know, bring tech jobs. You write a lot about the future of tech jobs and how we need to expand our definition of what a tech job even is. Can you just walk us through an example of what this looks like in practice on the ground?
Sure. I start the book with Alex Hughes because I think it's so important that people not caricature this as let's make coal miners coders. That's a horrible way of thinking of this because most of the 25 million jobs don't require any real coding. In fact, the new mantra among a lot of tech companies is low code, no code, meaning these jobs don't require much coding and they don't even require a college degree. So Alex Hughes is making stuff. He's making refrigerators. He's making dishwashers. And he says, I know how to do this. My family knows how to do this in Kentucky. We go back generations where the Hughes make things. We're technicians. We build things. Now he's just doing it with some software that allows him to make smart appliances. And the point is he got a 6-month or 10-month credential in using that technology software. But the job itself is a manufacturing job. And so the technology jobs of the future are going to be manufacturing jobs, retail jobs, healthcare jobs, education jobs. They're going to require a technical proficiency. They're going to require some ability to understand or manipulate software, but they're not going to require advanced.
Right. So as I was reading your book, I couldn't help but think about Alec McGillis's book, Fulfillment, all about Amazon. We had him on the show earlier this year. And, you know, the story that he tells is, yes, these jobs come, but Amazon's not paying any taxes. So, you know, that limits the benefit or sort of the downstream effects that these communities where the new Amazon locations come can really provide to the people living there. How do you think about solving that problem? And is it perhaps, do we make too much? Is Amazon the exception and not the rule when it comes to these types of you know, relocations and companies opening new facilities?
Well, I love Alec McGillis's book. I think I cited it a few times in my own. And he's absolutely right that the jobs of Amazon warehouses are not often good paying, good dignified jobs where you have an algorithm as your boss, where people who are making $30 an hour are now making $15 an hour, where the work conditions are not safe and are taxing. And data centers often are disruptive in these communities and aren't creating jobs. The question, though, is not where will we create new Amazon fulfillment centers, workforce centers, is where will we create new Amazon digital jobs, which are paying $80,000 on average, which are good paying. And those shouldn't just be concentrated in a few cities, Seattle or Virginia. Those should be more distributed. And the workers need to have more pay and benefits and dignity, which Amazon can afford. So I think we need a decentralization of the good paying digital jobs, and we need a raising of standards of the service jobs that often are accompanying those digital jobs.
Yeah, and this idea of dignity, I think, also gets to something you describe as the spirit of civility. And you talk a little bit about how this played out in your own life growing up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, not far from where we are here at Penn State. Can you just talk a little bit about that spirit, how it developed in you and how you see it today?
Well, I think on the Democratic side, we're very, very good about talking about fairness as a matter of rights, the right to healthcare, the right to education, the right to nutrition. But justice, in my view, requires more than just the right to the basic material goods, though those are so important. It requires the ability to contribute, the ability to make a meaningful difference, the ability to produce, and the ability to do that if you want for your hometown. And dignity to me was this sense that people don't feel like they have that opportunity anymore for them or their families, that they're being told to move, that they're told that their kids aren't going to have those opportunities, and that they don't want a future simply where you have redistribution, tax the billionaires in my district and provide them a handout. Now, we should tax the billionaires in my district, and we should tax Amazon more. But we have to do more than just the taxing and redistribution post-production and economy. We have to respect people's dignity, which means respecting their ability, talent to contribute, and providing them opportunities to do that. And in my view, I use dignity in a double sense. I say it means having an opportunity to contribute to economic life and to citizenship, to the citizenship life of a 21st century democracy. And that means having some say over the digital architecture, the digital public sphere.
Hey everyone, Jenna here with a look at another amazing show in the Democracy Group podcast network. This week we are highlighting Democracy Paradox, a show that is independently hosted and produced by Justin Kempf. Unlike a lot of the shows in our network, Justin started Democracy Paradox just out of his own curiosity and his desire to understand some of the inherent conflicts and tensions within political and democratic theory. If you think I read a lot of books about democracy, Justin has me beat tenfold, and he is able to draw from all types of sources and influences in the conversations that he has with scholars and practitioners. He's very thoughtful, a really great interviewer, and I learn a lot from his show, and I think you will too. So you can find Democracy Paradox wherever you listen to podcasts or at democracygroup.org. And now back to the interview. How important is it for Democrats to take credit for some of these gains, whether it's bringing these tech jobs or some of this work about building the new digital infrastructure? I'm thinking, for example, of former President Trump and the carrier plant and all of his talk about coal jobs. Now, some of that might be unique to his personality and his style of doing things, but it seems to me that Democrats have been more reluctant to say, no, we are the ones who are doing these things, who are bringing these benefits to you.
The president, I think, started in a great way when he recognized Intel in my district, the CEO, Pat Gelsinger, and he was able to say, we're bringing $20 billion into Ohio to revitalize the Midwest. That's Intel's investment. I mean, that's far more than Trump ever did with the carrier deal. It's not even comparable, or Foxconn. And yet the whole country knew about the carrier deal. And the whole country still doesn't know that Intel is putting $20 billion into Ohio after the president mentioned it in the beginning of the State of the Union. Every Democrat needs to be talking about the revitalization of America through new investment, through technology, which is going to create the new manufacturing jobs, the new retail jobs, the new construction jobs. Trump diagnosed a problem, and the problem was the deindustrialization of lots of parts of America. And he diagnosed the problem of communities left out. But his solution was not a true one. What we have to say is we understand the grievance. We understand the hurt. We understand the anger. Here is a plan to actually get opportunity, job creation, prosperity to communities for you and your kids.
And, political scientists have written a lot in recent years about the increasing polarization in the U.S. and how much stronger our national political identities are becoming, and how that, makes it difficult for people to work together, even when it is to achieve something that should ostensibly be a shared or common goal. How do you reckon with this idea of polarization in the work that you're doing and the ideas you have about how we move forward?
It's a big challenge. I mean, part of my thought is if we're working together and prospering together with the decentralization of technology, maybe that helps somewhat. The fact that Alex Hughes in Paintsville, Kentucky is working with an Indian American entrepreneur and with people in Silicon Valley and with people in Atlanta and Chicago, I can only think integrated teams, distributed teams, it can help to some extent mitigate the deep divisions. But it's going to take more than that. It's going to take listening to each other, respecting each other, figuring out how do we have some sense of common culture. And that's, of course, Douglass could believe that in 1869 when he defends Chinese immigration, this from a person who was enslaved for 20 years, and he writes, America is on the ascent, and I believe we're going to become the first multiracial, multiethnic democracy. We're going to be this composite nation. Certainly, he overcame much harder odds than we do. He gives the hope that we could do that in trying to better understand each other and have honest dialogue and try to understand where people are coming from. But I think the prerequisite for that is to have economic opportunity in places left out.
Right. And I think there's also perhaps at play here too, rebuilding or reestablishing trust in some of the institutions that are necessary to make democracy work. You know, some people certainly think that the media is lying to them. Politicians are bought and sold by lobbyists and corporations. Businesses are just out to screw them over. So where does that idea of trust fit into this thesis?
Trust is a huge deficit, but how do we gain that trust? I mean, the question is, what do we need to do for that trust? I think we need to do concrete things like President Biden did with Intel, $20 billion, 30,000 jobs. This is not just policy. This is not just abstraction. This is happening in the community. And then to tell those stories, and then people say, okay, this is working. When it's just legislative, when it's just abstract, that I think generates cynicism. So the more concrete proof points we have, the more we can slowly build trust.
Right. And, you know, this also, I think, gets to some of the racial disparities in technology, particularly some of the higher end jobs in engineering and software development and the like, which, you know, we know from the work of scholars and journalists, what can happen when, you know, algorithms and systems are not designed by people who are representative of the communities that they serve. And I know you also outline ideas for how to solve that part of the problem.
Well, I think that the digital architecture is so important in defining the rules of debate and defining who gets to have a voice. And it's not fair for that digital architecture to be constructed simply in Silicon Valley. There ought to be a more people having a stake in that architecture. Let me give you an example. Clubhouse, you know, popularized by Black artists, has very few Black engineers or Black people in leadership. And that is a reason, in my view, one reason why you have rampant sexism, rampant racism on the platform. So having a more inclusive design and teams will lead to the platforms themselves being more respectful of different.
We are in the midst right now of I think still a realignment when it comes to remote work and where people are going to live versus where they work and how that ties into a sense of place, which I know you define as very important to democracy and really making a lot of these ideas that you outline work. Tell us more, you know, about, you know, the importance of sense of place as you see it and maybe how you see that continuing to evolve as more companies shift to remote or hybrid work.
Well, this is my corollary to Adam Smith, who obviously had the sense that well, markets work and are efficient and we should allow people to move around wherever the jobs take them and to construct a society based on trade. And there's a lot to recommend markets. There's a lot to recommend trade. But I say it can't be unconstrained, unrestricted with no sense of place. That when you just tell people move, go where the jobs are, go trade, and you have no sense of respecting community, respecting place, then you end up destabilizing communities. You end up destroying hope and opportunity for many people who can't afford to move or don't want to move. And you end up creating deep polarization as is beset not just our democracy, but many democracies in the West. And so my sense is let's have some focus in our democratic society on, yes, economic growth and economic development, but also a focus on place and making sure that every place has a chance to participate in that. And it was most acute in the case of the digital revolution, which has left out so many places in this country.
Right. And, you know, you outlined so many policy proposals and policy ideas in this book. We don't have time to get to them all in this conversation, but how do you think about how to prioritize them moving forward? Are there certain things, or is there an order that you see, or certain, you know, hierarchy of, you know, what we need to be tackling first?
Well, the book was supposed to be a conversation starter, not sort of, here is my manifesto for the digital age, but more, here are some ideas. What do you think? And let's experiment on what can be done. But if I had to pick, I would say, let's do two goals. One, a jobs goal. Let's create 2 million new digital jobs for rural Americans and Black and Brown Americans in the next 5 years. I think that's achievable and can be done with a partnership between universities and the private sector with the federal government's leadership. And two, let's make sure that we have some real legislation on an Internet Bill of Rights that gives people rights online so that the worst excesses of online speech are...
Last question, Congressman. What does democracy mean to you?
Democracy to me means the recognition of the genius and extraordinary potential of each individual. The idea that you don't have to be a king or an aristocrat to have an extraordinary life, to have a meaningful life. It's not just about the right to vote. It's a fundamental belief that contribution and excellence of living is something that is accessible to all, and not just to the privileged few. And that's a radical thought. It's a thought that probably only has been really vibrant for the past 100 to 200 years, certainly in terms of being inclusive. It's a true thought, but we have a long way to go to make it a reality.
Right. Well, thank you for all of your work in this book and in Congress to try to get us closer to that reality. And thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Jenna, for that great interview. One of the things that stands out to me as I was listening to Representative Khanna, but and also, you know, reading the book, is that he seems to, you know, kind of be like a mix of an optimist and a pragmatist. And, you know, one of the ways that we see this is in his kind of notions of progressive capitalism. You know, and I think that, you know, we can point to a lot of problems with capitalism, but, you know, as a pragmatist, I think politically I think he sees it as important for us to consider, well, what are our constraints and how do we work within our constraints?
What are the constraints regarding capitalism, or what are the constraints regarding his role as a U.S. rep?
Both.
Uh-huh.
Both.
All right. So I think you're right. And I think he, but I also think that his position is fairly principled, and it's not unique to him, right? I mean, there's a lot of people who will argue that Nehru was a socialist in India, right? And really achieved little to nothing in terms of the well-being of your average Indian. And then India embraced capitalism. And as a result of that, you know, for whatever good or bad, I mean, for all the negatives, it well enhanced the well-being of your average Indian. And so there is an argument to be made that there is no economic system that is as powerful as producing wealth and enhancing the economic well-being of people as capitalism. However, and I think that's what Ro Khanna would say, and that's what people in the Silicon Valley would say. However, he would also say that that an unbridled capitalism, an unregulated capitalism, a capitalism where there are no values or objectives outside of the profit margin or profit motive, is just not good. It's not, it doesn't produce good ends for the people that it claims to serve. It only serves a select few.
You know, so let me just preface this. When I was in graduate school, I took a class and, you know, we have to do these weekly responses. And we would get an assessment on the responses. And the one day, I can't remember what we were talking about, but the response on my paper was, "Candace, you don't know shit about capitalism." And I was like, okay. And I think on some level, I have always shied away from thinking a lot about capitalism because I was discouraged from doing that. But it also seems that with capitalism, as we've seen it, we also see increases in inequality. We see lots of exploitation. And I just, you know, I think the other thing is that, like, there's this idea about the free market. And the fact of the matter is that we never have free markets. The U.S. government in particular, and maybe in other countries, I don't know, has always helped capital. Mm-hmm. And so they've used the power to enhance inequality, inequity, and exploitation. And so I guess I'm curious to know if you think that we are at a point when our political representatives have the will and that the public has an understanding of the dynamics in such a way to kind of say, like, all right, well, let's let the government use its power to undo some of the things that we've seen. I feel at the center of many of the arguments here is leveraging capitalism for good. Mm-hmm. And I just haven't seen evidence of that doing good for the most amount of people.
Right. There is a tradition. It's probably a minority tradition, and it probably only happens in periods, or is most likely to happen in periods of crises. But there are times in American history where we have constrained capitalism, right? Clean Water Act constrained capitalism. Clean Air Act constrained capitalism. These were, you know, the air and the water were, you know, economists call them public goods and externalities. And so the capitalist was able to say, hey, look, I'm not doing anything. I'm just, you know, putting in the air. It's just the air. And then we come to find out that that's not good for everyone. And so eventually, government stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. And OSHA is the same thing, right? These put constraints on capitalism in order to serve ends other than profit, other than an individual's profit. I think that Ro Khanna greatly underestimates the power, the condition of our society right now with respect to advancing the role of government as a constraint on capitalism.
I see. Yeah, I guess even as you're talking about like clean air and clean water, I was thinking of like Flint and of like red line areas that still have worse air than places that weren't red line. So, you know, even then, like the incentives have often been to, you know, ensure that people who are better off stay better off, and those who are worse off can be, you know, that's where you're are made worse off.
No, I think he oversells that, to be quite honest. I don't think it's nearly as easy, or, well, not easy. He doesn't say it's easy. I don't think it's nearly as viable as he would argue it is. But I mean, I have a hard time arguing against any one of the goals that are in there. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Sure. I actually think that one of the things that is helpful in the book is that he does kind of correct the idea about tech just being these jobs where people are on their computers, right? That tech does still have a manufacturing component.
Right.
And there are some other kind of other, you know, like I think, for example, in farming is a place where, you know, our ideas and concerns about climate change intersect with technology, intersect with also kind of racial equity matters. There are actually a lot of Black farmers and farmers of color
right.
who have been carved out of that occupation systematically. But there are, right, there are opportunities to invest here with technology. You know, one of the things I think, if I were just going to like try to tap into my optimistic side, is that, you know, when we talk about moments, right, that there are moments when we see the government moving, you know, toward constraining capitalism. There are moments that we see more racial equity. There are these moments. And I wonder if this will be a moment where we see that, you know, people are freaking out about gas prices and inflation. And so I wonder if this is a moment of opportunity where we can see like, hey, maybe we should have more green energy and technology here. And that those, you know, that kind of work could be done in rural places.
There is this sense in which this book is fundamentally laying out a vision of what's possible. And a vision for, you know, democratic politics going forward that engages people who feel resentment and who feel left out. And it's the policy, you know, you said it, it's like a laundry list. This is not your typical political laundry list. It's thoughtful, it's well documented. And you know, we should feel grateful to have it part of our political discussion. So thank you to Ro Khanna for writing the book. Thanks to Jennifer for the terrific interview. I'm Chris Beam.
And I'm Candace Watt-Smith. Thanks for listening.